Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Steven Schwarzman. Steve is the co-founder and chief executive officer of the Blackstone Group, the largest alternative investment firm in the world and a Fortune 500 company with revenues exceeding $6.8 billion and more than half a trillion dollars in assets under management. Steve is also the author of the book, What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence, which focuses on impactful episodes from Steve's life designed to show readers how to build, transform, and lead thriving organizations. In this interview, Steve shares stories from his childhood, from his time as an undergraduate at Yale, and his early career in Wall Street. He also tells stories from leading one of the biggest mergers in history to date as a fourth-year associate at Lehman Brothers, who had never done a merger before, as well as tales from the founding and growth of Blackstone. We also discuss the importance of having a strong culture and hiring the best people, how and why China bought 9.9% of Blackstone when it went public, the Schwarzman Scholars Program that he's developed in China, and a variety of other topics. Steven Schwarzman, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, Steve, you've recently written a book, What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence, a great read that I certainly recommend to all listeners here, and wanted to talk to you a bit about some of what you describe in the book and more generally about your career. You begin the book early on talking about your childhood in Philadelphia and the impact that your family business had on you. Your father ran a business which was, you describe it as a bit like a Bed Bath and Beyond. It was a very good concept. The store was always filled with customers. But then you discovered you had more ambition for the business than your father did. And I wonder if you could pick up the story there and talk a bit about the lessons that you drew from the difference in perspective between your father and yourself.
Yeah, sure. I started working at the store somewhere in my, first decade. I don't know whether I was 8, 9, or 10. But by the time I was 14, I was working at the handkerchief counter on weekends, and I found that to be not so interesting, watching people take out handkerchiefs out of boxes, figure out what they wanted, which was mostly not buy them, and then I had to put all the handkerchiefs back in the box. And so this didn't seem like much of a career for me. I did notice that the store was very busy, and I said to my dad, I said, why don't we expand this all over the country, much like Sears was at that point. It was a very healthy business, unlike the way it is now. And my dad said, no, I don't really want to do that. I said, well, why not? We could be really successful. And he said, I really don't want to do that. So I figured, he just didn't want to be that ambitious. So I suggested maybe we expand all over Pennsylvania. And he said he didn't want to do that either. So then I figured maybe he didn't want to travel. So we should expand all over Philadelphia. We could probably put 6 or 7 stores there. And he said he didn't want to do that either. So I said, Dad, why don't you want to do any of this? And he said, he was a happy man. He had everything he wanted in life. He had 2 cars. He had a house. And he had saved enough money to send his children to college. And he aspired for nothing more in life financially. And I sort of listened to that and, sort of somewhat surprised, because part of, doing these types of expansions is just the interesting thing of doing it and being successful, not just financially successful. But, I realized my dad just was a happy, contented person, and that not all people, you know, see, you know, sort of more ambitious things. And, you know, I love my dad. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I was sort of fine with it, but I couldn't understand completely why he didn't want to take something that was very good and be able to really move it further.
That's interesting. And Steve, so many young boys admire their fathers. Clearly you did as well and want to emulate them. Many boys for a long time want to go into the business or whatever sort of vocation their father does because it's the male figure in their life. But this was a point of contrast between the two of you from a fairly early age. Where do you think that drive, that contrasting drive to your father's came from?
Well, I think it came mostly from my mother, who was extremely ambitious for all of us. And, you know, she was a very good match, if you will, with my dad in terms of temperament. You know, so I got genes from both of them. And, you know, fortunately, my dad was extremely smart. And, you know, I got some of those leftover genes and very easy to be with. I got a bunch of those genes. And on the other hand, I did get the really aggressive, ambitious, you know, sort of focus that my mother had. So in a way, like all of us, I was the creation of both of our parents.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, that ambition presented itself in some very unusual ways as you were growing up. You tell a fascinating story of your time in high school where you wanted to sort of make a splash for your high school class and invited one of the biggest groups of the day, Little Anthony and the Imperials, to do a concert at your school. Now, mind you, doing so with no budget whatsoever and no contact directly to the band, like some sort of back door into the, you know, leadership of the band or something like that. Can you talk a bit about that process? And again, kind of sort of how it occurred to you that that was even possible?
Yeah, that was really interesting because when I was elected sort of the president of student council, I was actually that summer going on a trip to California with my mother and two brothers and driving across the country for no reason other than simply to see it. I would sit in the back seat imagining all these different things that I could do with this student council that nobody ever did before because I looked at it as a opportunity to create new things. Rather than just do what everybody else did. Now, exactly why I'm like that, I don't know. But every day I would send a postcard to the other officers of the student council with ideas I had, and they must have been somewhat quizzical about why they kept getting these postcards. But in any case, we sort of settled on getting a major rock group because that had never happened, of course, in a suburban high school. And I honest to goodness, can't remember exactly how we did that. Somebody was knew somebody, one of the parents, because I started just asking around the school, you know, like, and we managed to convince them for some reason to come to the high school. And was sort of amazing. I've done other things like that in my life, sort of just dream and imagine of what could be really fantastic. And then managed to make it happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. It would seem that such an impossible wish that would come true at such an early age would set you on a course to feeling as though having high ambition is the appropriate approach because, you know, again, your wish was confirmed in that case. It seemed like it was really an affirming event for you in your life.
Well, yeah, you know, in life, just sort of generally, if you have a great vision of something you'd really like to do or achieve, it's the vision itself that that orients you. And how you get there is important too, because if you don't get there, you know, then the vision collapses. But it's having something powerful that many people would rally to that makes it possible to do things. You have to be clever, you know, once you've figured that out. But I call them like worthy fantasies of things that people would want or to get. And you know, usually if you have a wonderfully conceived program of some type, any type, and it's really compelling, it's a lot easier to make it happen than something that's really expected or more pedestrian.
Very interesting. You're also very candid in the book that yours was not a rise without blemishes. You talk about, after a very successful high school career academically, also athletically, you were a track star. You went to Yale. And in your first English paper, based on your first few grades there, one wouldn't have expected that you would have been up to the task of writing a book necessarily. You described being a 68 on your first, as a first grade, a 66 on your next one. And your professor pulled you aside. And another sort of a very important sort of a seminal moment in your career, or I should say in your life intellectually, was him helping you learn how to write and think, as he put it. And I wonder, you know, if you could talk a bit about that experience. In some ways, as I say, your first failure, not literally, but certainly the worst grades you would have gotten to that point in your life, and a point at which perhaps you might have been questioning, do I belong here? And through the goodness of this professor who saw something more than what you were delivering, decided to invest in you. Can you talk a bit about that, please?
Yeah, that was almost game over for me. I got a 68 on my first English paper reviewing a story called Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville. And then they assigned a second piece on Melville for a paper, and I got a 66. So I've never gotten a 68 in my life, let alone a 66 after it. So the trend seemed pretty grim. And I went to, the professor called me in for a meeting, and he said, Mr. Schwarzman, I think we need to talk about your English papers. I said, why is that? He said, well, why do you think? I said, well, there's no reason to talk about them. He said, why? And I said, because I had nothing to say, and I said it poorly. At which point he responded, my God, you're not stupid. He said, I actually couldn't have summarized your work any better myself. He said, so it's clear you know how to think, but you don't know how to analyze anything, and you don't know how to write. And he said, you can't do both things at the same time if you don't know how to do either. And so I'll teach you how to write, and I'll give you the answer to the next situation or two. And after you learn how to write, then I'll teach you how to think. And he did. And by the end of the first year, instead of failing out of school, I ended up on a dean's list, which was the top 10% of the class. So without him, I wouldn't have made it. And so what you learn from that is that other people can intercept your life and make a huge difference. They can protect you. They can encourage you. They can show you a way. Even when you're doing badly, it may just be because of lack of training as opposed to basic capability. That was all, you know, it was like totally important to me. And it taught me that whenever I can help anyone do better, if they're struggling, you know, then I should do it. And if everybody did stuff like that, you know, the world would certainly be a better place.
Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting. And you talk a bit about how when you first arrived on Wall Street, you were kind of thrown into the deep end. It was actually quite a sharp contrast, as opposed to having nurturing people around you who are recognizing that your shortcomings were due to gaps in your knowledge, not a lack of capabilities. You were literally thrown annual reports that you didn't even know how to read at that point. And you talk a lot about it, echoing the sentiment you just described, that this really provided you, you know, sort of the notion that if you were ever in a position of bringing in bright people who simply didn't yet have the right experience in order to be successful in the firms that you ran, that you'd have world-class training associated with that as well. Again, I'd love your insights there.
Well, you know, a lot of us really learn things through our own experience. And I had, you know, sort of a, as you mentioned, a similar experience where my first job where, you know, nobody taught me anything. They just expected me to know it, and I didn't know anything. And they didn't have any mechanism for me to learn. And so, you know, fortunately, I ended up going back to business school and limped my way through for about 7 months. But, you know, I realized that, that's not the way you treat people in any setting. You want to make it as easy and comfortable for them to be successful. And why wouldn't you want that? Because it helps your organization. It helps the individuals. It creates a much more supportive culture where people like to be. And so after two sort of tough experiences, I realized, you know, if anybody joins any organization I'm involved with, it's going to have much better outcomes for them than it necessarily would have for me.
That's great. I do want to linger on your time at Harvard Business School briefly, because there's a fascinating story you tell of going to see the dean there and having remarkable chutzpah to tell him very frankly what you thought to be the shortcomings of the school at that time, which were rather expansive and incredibly frank. And I wonder if you could, you know, retell that story as well as some of the lessons from that.
Well, you know, I went to Harvard Business School in 1970, which was right in the middle of the Vietnam War. And as a result of that, and business supplying armaments for Vietnam, it was the business schools generally were held in very low esteem by students. And you know, I had applied for, you know, like all the good law schools, you know, sort of Harvard and Yale, you know, Stanford, Chicago, and you know, I didn't get in anywhere. So that left me with business school. And I only applied to one of them, which was Harvard, and I got in. And so when I went there, the students weren't up to the same quality as where I went as an undergraduate. The professors were all young and barely knew how to teach. The course materials seemed pretty obsolete. The administration did a number of things that seemed to make no sense to me. And it was clear that the place wasn't well run. So I made an appointment, which took months, to go and see the dean of the business school and share my perceptions, because I'm sure he didn't know that the place was doing badly, and how to solve each one of those four areas, and how to recruit better students and have more modern curriculum and train first year teachers, which I don't think they did enough of, and reform the administration itself. You know, he just sort of sat there, listened to my observations and my solutions. And then he said, "Mr. Schwarzman, have you always been a misfit?" And I said, "No, not really. I said, you know, I was president of my junior high school. I was president of my high school. I was running graduation ceremonies in my university. And I said, if you bothered to learn, I'm the head of your number one organization here at the business school. So I'm not really a misfit. I said, that's not the problem. The problem is really the school. And you know, we should talk about that. So he said, frankly, I don't need your advice. And basically whisked me out of his office. And there I knew what the problem was when you have a leader who basically is completely unresponsive, who doesn't want to know what's going on, then you're going to have bad outcomes. And as it worked out, Harvard went from number one when it was ranked when I was there, but I could tell it was already really getting weaker, down to, I believe it was number six or seven among the schools in the United States. Took about 20 years, but that's what happened. And now it's climbed back under completely different deans. But, you know, I've always found that you know, if you see a problem, you should tell people. And you should give a positive solution. It's not about being critical. It's just being about something where you see it and it's right. That's the way it is. You can't get away from that. And you should address it and solve it. People who don't do that, either because they're scared, that's a bad idea. But leaders who don't listen are very infrequent. Most people in leadership positions are there because they want to do a good job, and it's good to help them. But that was certainly a shock to me at the business school.
You joined Lehman Brothers, and you had an extraordinary experience in 1977 when the president of Tropicana, you were not even a partner, I should mention, Lehman Brothers, plucked you to get involved in one of the most complicated, nearly a $500 million merger. And it was an opportunity for you. You've told it in the past that that you've attributed part of your success as an ability to operate under conditions of complete fear. And this was certainly one of those. And I wonder if you could just talk a bit about that experience and this extraordinary tale of a Friday afternoon call that you got from the leadership at Tropicana.
Yeah, this was complete and utter fear, I must say. I had never done a merger and acquisition transaction in my career. I was about a fourth or fifth year associate at Lehman Brothers, which is at that point a great investment bank. And I was in Chicago and working on a project, and I got a phone call from the president of Tropicana, which most people in the United States would know makes orange juice. He asked if I could go to Florida, where their headquarters was, to represent them in the potential sale of their company. And he wanted to know if we had a conflict with the group that was buying it. And, you know, so I called the office and had some people, you know, to check as to whether we had a conflict, which I was told we didn't. And so I flew to Florida. It was a Friday, end of the day. And, you know, I didn't have any clothes for the weekend because I was flying back to my home in New York. At least that was the schedule. But now I was going to Florida. And there were big snowstorms that afternoon in Florida, and so the plane was really delayed, and I didn't get to Florida until 4 a.m, and I'd never done a merger before, so he gave me the names of the two companies. That was all, and I had a little what they called a stock guide, which had a few elementary facts about companies in general by name. And so I had that information, and I just tried to figure out how would you do a merger? How would it look like if one company bought another? What kind of price? What would happen at different prices to both the buyer and the seller? So I was sort of teaching myself on airplanes, like what this might look like. And when I got there at 4 o'clock, there were no taxis because I was in a small town in Florida, Bradenton, Florida. So it took another hour. So I got to my motel at 5, and I had to be at the company at 7:30. And so I didn't even sleep. I laid down for a bit, took a shower, but I just didn't have a comb. And put the same clothes back on. went to this company where the president who had called me laid out the price that they had agreed to, and there were three different potential structures that could be used. And so he left me in a room, and he said the board meeting will be starting in a half an hour. We'd like to have your recommendation. Now, I never been to a board meeting in my life. And I had never done a merger, so I knew I was in desperate trouble. And this merger turned out to be the second biggest in the world that year. Also, this wasn't a little project. The first thing I did is I called the chairman of Lehman Brothers, my firm, and I told him about my situation. And he said, well, I'm not an expert in this area. You should call the number two person at the firm. Richard. So I woke him up
he was on a Saturday morning, as you say.
Yeah, Saturday morning at like 7:10. So he wasn't happy. And he said, well, of these three choices, I think two of them could work. He said, I think the deal's probably fair. And you should call the number three person at the firm. So I woke him up. I said, what do you think we should do? He sort of said the same as the first guy, the number two person at the firm. So at this point, I knew sort of he said, look, you just pick the one you like. And I'm saying to myself, pick the one I like, and then he hung up. And so then I went into this board meeting, and I'd never been to a meeting. So the head of the company who owned a good deal of it, Mr. Rossi, asked me to come over and sit next to him. He's sort of a bit like Marlon Brando in The Godfather, in that scene with the where he was growing tomatoes with that same kind of accent from Sicily. He had only about six or seven people on the board, one of whom was the former governor of Florida, and I had never met a governor in my life. I had heard of this gentleman, and so he said, well, we're going to start the meeting now. And I realized there was a lady who was sitting to my right, who was a stenographer, going to keep records of everything I said, which was slightly intimidating, only to be exceeded by the two tape recorders on the table that were both put on to make sure that anything I said would be definitely recorded. And so I just started out sort of went on autopilot. I talked with the people on the board as to what their objectives were and figured out which of these three alternatives made sense. Then we went I represented Tropicana and went into the other room and talked about with the buyers, about what we would prefer and how that might be structured and so forth. And, you know, sort of spent the whole day working on this issue. And meanwhile, the previous night I had missed a dinner party at my house. And my wife didn't even know where I was. And that was before there were cell phones. So you just couldn't make a call.
Right.
So I finally caught up with her and, she was between anxious and frantic and angry. Why had I missed the dinner party? And I said, look, I'm in the middle of complete chaos here. I said, I'll see you, later tonight. And then, unfortunately for me, the same snowstorm from Chicago traveled to New York. And I didn't get in until 4 in the morning again.
Oh, my goodness.
And, it was like a complete disaster. And meanwhile, I had done the second largest transaction in the world, just sort of pretty much on my own, which was on the front pages of all the newspapers and so forth. I was 30 years old, and fortunately for me, my instincts of reaching out to people who were smarter than I was as fast as I could, and the ability to just not panic as you're going through something, got me through it.
That's great. And you've mentioned in the past that when you asked the president of Tropicana, why me, that he said, that is, why did he choose you? I mean, actually, as you review the details of how significant this was, and certainly he was a person who could have chosen whoever he wished, perhaps to be involved in this. But he said, because you have the ability to make complicated things simple. What an interesting response.
Yeah, that's what I do. I see the world somewhat simply. I'm not the brightest person in the world, but I can typically sort through all the clutter and figure out the one or two or three important things that are going on. And if I can figure those out, I can certainly explain to anyone else how I'm thinking about that. And so that's the way I approach life. And, that's how I'm able to explain what other people think are complicated things. They're actually not so complicated. You can make them complicated, but they're usually one or two really important things, maybe three, that you have to understand. And if you understand them, you can explain them.
Mm-hmm. The first of the three calls that you made that Saturday morning, as you mentioned, was to Pete Peterson, who of course would become a very important person in your life and you to his, you were the two co-founders of Blackstone, the firm that you still run. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about, you mentioned in the book quite often, the necessity of finding, in your case, a co-founder or people to surround yourself with who are complements to yourself. And he was certainly that. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think, nobody really, except maybe a great basketball player, is completely self-reliant. You can be good at many, many things. You can be great at some things, but you're not typically outstanding at everything that you have to do in a job. And other people are simply better. Some people are great inventors, but they're not good marketing people. Some people are brilliant investors, but they can't raise money because they're inarticulate. So a lot of great organizations often have two people involved with them that offset and complement each other. And I think it's important to recognize that nobody sort of is an island. And you can't build anything or grow anything just as one person. And you always have to look at hiring people who are as terrific as you can find, who have skills that are not necessarily duplicative of your own.
Yeah, very interesting. And fast forwarding quite a bit into your experience in Blackstone, you elected to go public, an unusual move for a firm in the private equity space at that time. And it also, a particular note, got you back into the orbit of China. You had not been at that point, this is 2006, 2007, you hadn't been to China since 1990, so certainly not a country you were very familiar with. But you found out that they were becoming familiar with you and were quite interested in this. Can you share that that experience, of course, because it's certainly colored other things you've done since?
Yeah, no, it was pretty interesting that we decided to go public for a variety of reasons. My partner wanted to retire, and I thought that he deserved the higher valuation that you would get if you were a public company than just selling your stock to somebody else who already worked at the firm at a much lower price. And I also was concerned about the environment. And, you know, I thought, you know, we were developing a lot of bubbles and intuitively wanted to have more capital in our business to protect it for any economic downturn. We were in the process doing that type of offering. We had announced it, and the way the legal thing works is you announce it, and then the SEC has to review your documents, and that took a few months. And in that period, we got an unsolicited approach by the Chinese government that wanted to buy 9.9% of our company, Blackstone, that the value of that would be $3 billion. And I was sitting at home, and my new partner for China, who worked for us, called me and said that China wanted to give us $3 billion. The whole offering was $4 billion. So I was sort of wondering, how could they buy three quarters of of the offering? The only way, of course, was you had to expand the offering from $4 billion to $7 billion, which we did. And we gave them non-voting stock without a board representation because I didn't even know who they were. The offering itself was second biggest of the first decade of the 21st century. The only larger IPO was Google's. So Blackstone's was quite consequential. But not just the size, the fact that China, the country who bought our stock, had not bought stock in a foreign company since modern China was formed in the late 1940s, was a huge compliment to the firm and a symbol that China wanted to start entering the world and recycling the enormous financial reserves that they had. So it was like a really breathtaking kind of situation that we did nothing in particular to seek.
Mm-hmm. Remarkable. Blackstone was founded in 1985. So all these years later, now well over $500 billion assets under management. What are some of the secrets to maintaining a great firm as it scales to the point that your firm has, Steve?
Well, one of the things is you have to have a wonderful culture. Everyone at the firm has to feel that they're important, that what they do is essential for the success of the firm. And they have to believe it's a meritocracy without internal politics. So all that's relevant is what their talent is. You have to teach people that we all need to be cooperative. You have to have a review process that's very fair so that you can give feedback to everyone so they can get better. If somebody just can't make it, then you try and help. But if they can't be helped, you have to ask them to leave so you keep your quality very high. When you hire people, You have to look for people who are 10s on a scale of 10. If you can't get a 10, you can hire a 9, but you can never hire lower than an 8. And the reason for that is that 8s hire 7s when they become senior. You don't want that. You only want the top people that you can find who are particularly terrific at what they do. And then I think also you have to have a culture of innovation, of always starting new things. Because if you start new things, you staff them with your existing people so that there's no glass ceiling. Nobody has to kill somebody else off to be able to be successful in life. We always find another position for them because we're always growing. So if you have a series of, sort of principles that you follow and that everyone at the business knows it, that's how you do it. And you realize that nothing lasts forever in the financial area. There are no patents. So whatever you invent that's clever, somebody can copy almost immediately. So it's a business where you need continual innovation. And you have to teach people that's what it takes. Just doing what you do as if it's going to last for the rest of your career is not the way it's going to work. So let's not assume that it does. And it makes people curious, makes them comfortable with change as opposed to anxious about it. That's the way we do it. One additional thing is that people have to see the top people in the organization with a lot of frequency, at least once a week, so that those top people can make it clear to everybody that just because you're successful at one point, that's temporary, and it's not meant to continue unless you do something special to make that happen. And one of our other principles is to not lose money. That sounds like a simple-minded type of thing, but you'd be amazed at the number of people who take risks to try and make large amounts of money. And that sounds great unless you lose the money. So you're better off not losing it. So we start our analyses not how good could something be, but how bad can it be? Because if it's really bad on the downside, it doesn't matter how much you might make on the upside. Because if you have a lot of losses, you have to earn so much money on the things that work. It puts too big a demand on the system. So if you start out not losing anything, then you don't have to be quite as aggressive, with the upsides. So if you put all that together, you can develop a really marvelous company.
That's excellent. The last question for you, Steve, I want to just spare a quick thought to the Schwarzman scholars, returning to the theme of China and the importance of the country to you in those early days of being a public company. Can you talk a bit about the rationale behind it and the vision for the Schwarzman scholars?
Yeah, I started the Schwarzman Scholars in concept in 2011, and it's a bit like the Rhodes Scholarship, where you take, in our case, 40% Americans, 40% students from the rest of the world, 20% Chinese students, all for a master's degree, and send them to a newly built college, Schwarzman College. In Tsinghua University, which is China's number one university. And why did we do that? The reason was because I felt that populism was definitely starting after the global financial crisis in the United States. And usually with populism, you get angry at business people or wealthy people or bankers. And that's because some people are having a hard time on a blame that on somebody, and usually there's a political leader that mobilizes that. But what happens is people's situations don't change as a result of deploying that anger, and then they get, they're looking for somebody else to get angry to. I thought that China was the number one target that would develop, because China was growing at, you know, sort of 3 to 4 times the rate of the United States. And, you know, it was getting the jobs, it was getting the wealth. And if you're angry at your own situation, being angry at China seemed to me to be a pretty high probability event. And what I wanted to do was basically make sure that the truth about what was going on in China was known, as opposed to just sort of somebody's imagination spreading as truth. And so I figured if we got a group of 150 to 200 superstars together, gave them a year to meet the heads, leaders of the country, let them see the rest of the country physically on trips, worked in either briefly in a Chinese ministry or company or not for profit, and had a mentor from Chinese society who could take them home and meet their families and friends, that this would be a group of people who would go back to their own countries and be people of influence, hopefully, by their nature. And be able to explain what was going on, not only with China, but also tell China if it wasn't doing things that would be as approved in other parts of the world, to give China feedback. And beyond that, be a source of sort of good thinking through and helping with other problems around the world. And so that was the concept. I got the president of China and President Obama to endorse that formally, which was great. And we've now are graduating our fourth class, and the students are absolutely remarkable, and they get along great. And I'm hopeful that our objectives to make the world a better place and prevent hostilities between countries in a lot of different ways will come to pass. But that's the background for the Schwarzman Scholars.
Well, thank you for that. Stephen Schwarzman, the book is What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. Thank you so much for sharing lessons from your remarkable journey in business and in life, Steve.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Stuart Russell, a leading artificial intelligence researcher and a professor at the University of California at Berkeley.